And he's very involved in Gamma Fight, which is a gay Mormon father organization associated with Affirmation. And here's Robert Olson.
It's good to be here this morning. This is the first time I've had the chance to attend the Sunstone Symposium, and so obviously it's the first time I've made a presentation at a symposium. I hope you'll feel free to interrupt and ask questions or make comments as we go along, and I would like to have a discussion period at the end of the presentation. So, let's get started. My subject is Evolution of Mormon Teachings on Marriage and Celibacy, and I put a little footnote here, a catch-22 for gay Mormons. One of the most divisive social issues of the day concerns the right to marry. Gay organizations are working through the courts to obtain legal recognition of same-sex marriages and the rights associated with the institution. Many groups, including the Mormon Church, are involved in an active campaign to assure that gay men and lesbians are not allowed to marry. Many of the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have evolved during the 170 years since its founding. It is certainly true for teachings on marriage and celibacy. This presentation will look at how these teachings have evolved to create a no-win situation for gay and lesbian Mormons and their families. By maintaining a zero-tolerance stand on acceptable sexual relationships, the Church has embraced a teaching that was once considered to be of the devil in order to deal with its homosexual problem. Church leaders declare that homosexual members must play by the same rules as heterosexual members, but are working hard to see there is not a level playing field. This activity is justified as being pro-family, but can also be considered as anti-gay. Let me tell you a little bit about myself so that you'll know what biases I bring to the presentation. I'm a fourth and fifth generation Mormon, from polygamist ancestors, was born and raised in Provo, Utah. One of my maternal great-great-grandfathers, Lorenzo Dow Young, a brother of Brigham Young, had five wives and 16 children. One of his sons, John Ray Young, my great-grandfather, had four wives and 22 children. Another maternal great-grandfather, Thomas Sunderland Hawkins, had three wives, 22 children. So they were pretty prolific ancestors I come from. Thomas Hawkins was, interestingly, the first Mormon to be arrested and imprisoned for practicing polygamy. I was married to Jody King, and we have two adult children. 2 years after telling her that I was gay, we decided that the best way to maintain our friendship was to separate, and we were divorced in 1966 after 31 years of marriage. 1996. I'm not that old. After 31 years of marriage, and this was certainly the most difficult thing that we, either one, have ever gone through. Yeah, our divorce, but we have remained friends and have maintained our family unit. I have been active in the church most of my life. I served a mission in the Central States and have held many church positions, although with very mixed emotions. Just recently I turned in a letter asking that my name be removed from the church records, so I won't be a member of the church soon, but I do consider myself to be a Mormon. And that is my upbringing background. Let's start by looking at some of the teachings of Joseph Smith as they relate to marriage. Revelations given to Joseph Smith relating to marriage are sections 131 and 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Some teachings contained in these sections were radical when compared with teachings of Christian churches at the time, while others reflected norms of society. It is clear from the first few verses of section 132 that the new and everlasting covenant presented in these sections relates to plural marriage, one man married to two or more women. And if you'll bear with me, I'm going to read just some verses out of the Doctrine and Covenants to set the basis for the presentation. D&C 131 through 4. Verily thus saith the Lord unto my servant Joseph, that insomuch as ye have inquired of my hand to know and understand wherein I, the Lord, justified my servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as also Moses, David, and Solomon, my servants, as touching the principle and doctrine of having many wives and concubines. So this sets the tone for the revelation. Behold, and lo, I am the Lord thy God, and will answer thee as touching this matter. Therefore, prepare thy heart to receive and obey the instructions which I am about to give unto you. For all those who have this law revealed unto them must obey the same. For behold, I reveal unto you a new and everlasting covenant, and if ye abide not that covenant, then ye are damned. For no one can reject this covenant and be permitted to enter into my glory. Not only will one be damned for not accepting the new and everlasting covenant, but cannot be exalted without entering into marriage. One could argue this means plural marriage, as declared in section 131. In the celestial glory there are three heavens or degrees, and in order to obtain the highest, a man must enter into this order of the priesthood, meaning the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. And if he does not, he cannot obtain it. He may enter into the other, but that is the end of his kingdom. He cannot have an increase. I think it's interesting that this revelation seems to be primarily given to men in the church. If you notice, a man must enter into the order is said there. It goes on later in section 132 and says, and again as pertains to the law of the priesthood, if any man espouse a virgin and desire to espouse another, and the first give her consent, and if he espouse the second, and they are virgins and have vowed to no other man, then is he justified. He cannot commit adultery, for they are given to him, for he cannot commit adultery with that belongeth to him and to no one else. And if he have 10 virgins given to him by this law, he cannot commit adultery, for they belong to him, and they are given to him, therefore he is justified. Now for the presentation today, and looking at how things have evolved within the church, I want to look at four areas taken from the 132nd section. One is that marriage is essential for exaltation, that polygamy is a new and everlasting covenant, the women are property of men, and sex in marriage is for procreation. So we will go through and look at these concepts and see how they have evolved or not evolved over the time since this revelation was given. The concept that a person's exaltation is dependent on a relationship to another person was radical at the time of Joseph Smith. And even today, in most Christian churches, salvation is an individual matter, depending on one's personal relationship with God. Since marriages generally are for this life, the relationship of a couple does not directly impact salvation. It is interesting that women are particularly dependent on finding a faithful man who would marry them to assure their exaltation. Carrie A. Miles in Polygamy and the Economics of Salvation, it appeared in Sunstone, argues that plural marriage had little to do with sex or love, but was practiced to provide salvation and economic security for female members of the church. The essential nature of marriage has remained a core teaching of the church until the present day. Elder Dallin Oaks said in a recent article, the emphasis on in text from quotes or my emphasis, not they were not in the quote itself. Elder Oaks said, "Our eternal destiny, exaltation in the celestial kingdom, is made possible only through the atonement of Jesus Christ, and is only available to a man and a woman who have entered into and been faithful to the covenants of an eternal marriage in the temple of God." So this time very radical teaching has remained consistent and really has not changed or evolved during the many years. I've also have a few cartoons I'd like to put on to as it relates to things. Exaltation and Becoming God. I thought this was a lot of fun. When We Return, More of Mormons, Ordinary People Trying to Become Gods. Now let's look at polygamy itself. As pointed out above, the start of section 132 indicates that the revelation deals with polygamy, marriage of a man to more than one woman. The new and everlasting covenant was not only eternal marriage, but eternal plural marriage during the early years of the church. This concept was very much at odds with both religious and secular thinking of the day. I will not go into the history of polygamy, but we all know the church discontinued the practice in 1890 so that Utah could become a state. It is interesting to note that Wilford Woodruff, in the manifesto, does not denounce the doctrine of plural marriage, but only commits the church to stop the practice. The manifesto, "And I now publicly declare that my advice to the Latter-day Saints is to refrain from contracting any marriage forbidden by the law of the land." Church leaders continued to perform clandestine marriages for some time following the manifesto. It was not until the administration of Heber J. Grant that the practice of polygamy was completely stopped within the church, as detailed in Polygamy and the Economics of Salvation. Quote, "When Heber J. Grant became the president of the church in 1918, the LDS people were led for the first time by a pharaoh who knew not Joseph. Although supportive of polygamy before the manifesto, as president, Grant would not tolerate it on any level. He repudiated polygamy as being necessary for salvation. He repudiated earlier church presidents' clandestine continuation of polygamy. He taught that celestial marriage and plural marriage were not the same. And he actively supported the prosecution of polygamists by the government. Under President Grant's administration, supporters of polygamy were excommunicated, and children of polygamy could not be baptized until they were old enough to repudiate plural marriage. There is every indication that present-day leaders of the church wish polygamy had never existed. In The Family, A Proclamation to the World, the church declared, "We, the First Presidency and the Council of the 12 Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, solemnly proclaim that marriage between a man and a woman is ordained of God, and that the family is central to the Creator's plan for the eternal destiny of his children. The church is actively and is actively participating in the political process to assure the definition of marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Since there is no mention of marriage between a man and two or more women, one could question what happens to plural marriages performed in the years before the manifesto. In actual practice, the church is conflicted on this issue, since a man who is civilly divorced or whose first wife has died may marry a second wife in the temple. Thus, church members are in effect still practicing polygamy. I have a relative who is married eternally to two women. He will not get a temple divorce from his first wife because he wants to assure her chance of exaltation, even though she has been inactive in the church for many years. I think this is how probably some men in the church feel. I always thought of myself as naturally polygamous, but unfortunately, the church makes no distinction between that gift and adultery. While the concept of women being the property of men is repugnant to us today, it was not a radical idea in Joseph Smith's day. In the verses from section 132 quoted earlier, it is clear that under the new and everlasting covenant, women were the property of men. And to repeat this, and he had 10 virgins given unto him by this law, he cannot commit adultery. They belong to him, and they are given unto him. Therefore, he is justified. Ownership of women by men has been accepted in the past and is practiced in some countries today. The Ten Commandments make it clear that women are property grouped along with servants, oxen, and asses, as can be seen in the Tenth Commandment. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. A few years ago, I lived for several months in Pakistan, where most marriages are arranged by parents. There, the bride is not present at the wedding, which takes place between the groom and the father of the bride. It's signing of papers that transfer ownership, legal ownership, from the father to the husband. And then after the wedding ceremony is over, the bride then enters the room, or then actually the wife enters the room. And in many cases, that's the first time the husband and wife have ever seen each other. So there still is a lot of the world that women are property of men. In the Western world, the basis of marriage has changed, and the teachings of the church have changed to reflect accepted practice. Gordon B. Hinckley described the relationship that should exist between husband and wife. Marriage, in its truest sense, is a partnership of equals, with neither exercising dominion over the other, but rather with each encouraging and assisting the other in whatever responsibilities and aspirations she may have. I thought this was pretty apropos. We need a change from a traditional marriage to an equal partnership marriage. Schedule it in. Ha 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 ha. But present teachings are not as clear as this quote would indicate. As the church seems to be conflicted on the practice of plural marriage, it is also unclear on relationships between husband and wife. Even though the partners of a marriage are to be equals, still the husband is the head of the family, as shown in this quote from the family, a proclamation to the world. By divine design, fathers are to preside over their families in love and righteousness, and are responsible to provide the necessities of life and protection for their families. Mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. In these sacred responsibilities, fathers and mothers are obliged to help one another as equal partners. I know often we talk about that men have the priesthood and women are the mothers, and that we put them on a pedestal. I thought this was like, sweetheart, you've fallen off your pedestal again. Section 132 is not as explicit on the place of sex in a marriage as it is on the other points discussed already, but does indicate the purpose of plural marriage is for procreation in verse 63. It says, "For they," referring to wives, "are given unto him to multiply and replenish the earth according to my commandment, and to fulfill the promise which was given by my father before the foundations of the world." Carrie A. Mills points out in her article on polygamy that sex was not a primary objective of plural marriages. Many questions that polyandry raised for outside observers and for us today were simply not a problem in early Mormonism, since the basis of plural marriage was salvation, not love, sex, or material production. There is evidence that plural marriage was not based on sexual attraction, although undoubtedly it was a strong motive in many cases. It goes on. In the first place, sexuality was not a feature of all plural marriages. Joseph Smith and many other church leaders felt it their duty to provide eternal salvation for older, unmarried women and widows. Indeed, Brigham Young once said he would no more make some of his elderly wives a real wife, i.e. sleep with her, than he would his grandmother. Some early leaders of the church taught that sex in marriage should be only for the purpose of having children. My mother told me that she was taught by the aunt who raised her after she was orphaned that sex was terrible, but it had to be endured in order to have children, which is probably not too uncommon an attitude in that time. And then he said, "Sex is no secret, it's sacred. And talking about it makes your mother faint." Fortunately, there has been liberalization in the views of sex within marriage. While sexual activity could be enjoyed between a legally married man and woman, it was still taught for many years that the purpose was procreation. The latest edition of the Church Handbook of Instructions, for the first time, acknowledges that sex in marriage is for more than procreation. Married couples also should understand that sexual relations within marriage are divinely approved, not only for the purpose of procreation, but also as a means of expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds between husband and wife. So, we just need permission to enjoy sex. A few years ago, my daughter gave me a copy of The Lenses of Gender. She had used it as a text in a women's study course at Brigham Young University and was sufficiently impressed to want me to read the book. The author, Sandra Bem, argues that assumptions about sex and gender are so embedded in our culture that we do not see them, but see through them. Her introduction says, "Not all males in U.S. society actually have power, of course, and the term male power should be construed narrowly as the power historically held by rich, white, heterosexual men. For it is they who originally set up, now primarily sustain, the cultural discourses and social institutions of this nation. It is thus not women alone who are disadvantaged by the organization of U.S. society, but poor people, people of color, and sexual minorities as well. Of the several other systemic oppressions, the oppression of lesbian and gay men so directly derives from the androcentric, gender-polarizing, and biologically essentialist definition of what it means to be a man and a woman that I have systematically integrated my analysis of this oppression into the structure of the book. Many of the lenses Ms. Bem identifies in the society at large also exist in the Mormon Church, since power is held in the hands of mostly rich, white, heterosexual men. I would argue that there are, in addition, lenses of marriage that we look through but do not see, and would like to make an initial effort to identify how beliefs on marriage might impact Mormon culture. Here are a few very preliminary ideas. So everyone will marry. Leave It to Beaver families are the only true families. If you want to get ahead in the church, get married. To be adult and single is to be second class. Let's just look at these a little bit more one by one. Since marriage is essential for exaltation, there has always been strong emphasis placed on members getting married. Socialization and training in home and church are focused on the eventual goal of marriage. The church is an extremely heterosexual coupled environment. I do not believe the pressure to marry is quite as strong today as in the past, but it is still there. The assumption has been that everyone would get married, as this quote by George F. Richards from the conference report of April 1924 illustrates. From the reports of 1923, we are informed that there are in the church 27,104 members of the church over 21 years of age who have never been married. When you think that this large tabernacle will seat about 8,000 people, multiply that number by 3.5, or nearly so, to equal the number of unmarried people in the church over 21 years of age. It is almost appalling. And then, if we were to add to that number the young women of the church between the ages of 18 and 21, who might be said to be of marriageable age, the number would be increased by some thousands. So I think there's a lot of pressure on us to get married. But the Beaver families are the only true families. A husband, wife, and 4.5 children has become the definition of family for the Mormon Church. While this limited definition may be the ideal, it is not the norm in real life and certainly excludes many, many families. So often our ideal doesn't measure up to the, or our actuality doesn't measure up to the ideal, does it? If you want to get ahead in the church, get married. For men who aspire to leadership positions in the church, marriage is essential. I know of a few single men who served as counselors in bishoprics, but never a single bishop, stake president, or higher office. There have likely not been many single Relief Society presidents in the church. And interestingly, after Eugene England's talk today, also if one wants to work at BYU, it also helps to be married. James Gordon, BYU's Vice President for Academic Affairs, said, "The university has the right to consider marriage when hiring staff." And I quote from him, "The church teaches that people have the duty to marry if they have the opportunity. If candidates are not married, would like to know whether they support the church's teachings about marriage and whether they desire to marry." This says, "Well, we decided that it was easier for each of us to keep our last names and let half the ward assume we are living in sin than for both of us to use the hyphenated name and have the elders' quorum think Michael is a wimp." To be adult and single is to be second class. Since marriage is the accepted norm, there is disapproval or even hostility for those outside the norm. The church segregates its adult single members from normal wards. This is probably necessary since so much of the church's program is oriented to married couples and children. Had example, I used to attend the Kensington ward, which is the ward where the temple is located, and there was a series of child-rearing classes that were given, and my wife at the time was in the Relief Society presidency, and so we decided, I was teaching the Elders Quorum, and we decided what we would do is, when those lessons were to be given, that we would divide the groups into those with children, which I would teach, and those without children, which the Relief Society teacher would teach, so that we were combining the elders and the Relief Society together. And most people seem to think it worked pretty well because the lessons could be appropriately structured. But unfortunately, we were told by the State Relief Society president that we couldn't do this anymore because the Relief Society could not meet with the elders' quorum. That was improper. So we had to stop it. But to me, that was an example of how I think single people often feel on the fringes or on the edges of what goes on in many of the activities of church.
Just a clarification. I mean, if you're single and over a certain age, you're required to be in a family board. So, I mean,
it has
only an option for those below certain ages.
Okay.
The complaints have generally been
I have one more cartoon here. It doesn't fit terribly well, but the idea that singles are says, with gay marriage going down in to defeat in Hawaii and Alaska, that means there will be a lot more available men. That's where I'd be headed if I were 25 and single, with no decent prospects on the horizon. This is a limited look at the impact of Mormon teachings on marriage that they have on the functioning of the church. The church environment is definitely coupled and heterosexual. It is not supportive and at times even hostile to singles and non-heterosexuals. Now let's move on to the other side of the issue, celibacy. With such a strong emphasis on marriage, it is not surprising that teachings on celibacy have not been cast in a favorable light. In fact, during much of the church's history, celibacy has been considered a tool of the devil for subverting God's plan, as shown in these quotes. This is the one that talked about how many unmarried people there were over 21. It continues on. Why then should there be so many members of the church of marriageable age who are not married? I am led to wonder if we are partaking of the spirit of the world in this thing. If I am correctly informed, there are religionists who believe that in the practice of celibacy you can get nearer to the Lord, that they can administer more satisfactorily to Him in the unmarried state than in the married relation. I am sure this is a great mistake and untrue doctrine. And then there's a big heading, forbidding to marry, a doctrine of devils. Indeed, I think I might say that it is a doctrine of devils, and I would quote you from the scriptures to sustain my understanding of this doctrine. And he quotes from 1 Timothy, which talks about forbidding to marry. And then he goes on. Here the Apostle Paul characterizes this forbidding to marry as a doctrine of devils, as I understand it, along with lies and hypocrisy, and one of the great evils that should characterize the falling away from truth in the last days. I hope as Latter-day Saints we are not imbibing these worldly ideas. And one more quote. This is from Bruce R. McConkie's New Doctrinal New Testament Commentary. Forbidding to marry. The practice of celibacy is an illustration of this. Since eternal life grows out of marriage, anything Satan can do to preserve or prevent the creation and continuance of this holy union is in his interest. And then he quotes from the Doctrine and Covenants, "Whoso forbiddeth to marry is not ordained of God, for marriage is ordained of God unto man." As the church has struggled with its homosexual problem, celibacy has evolved from a tool of devils to the Lord's approved plan. Church members with homosexual feelings are told to be celibate if they want to be members in good standing of the church. In peculiar people, Mormons and same-sex orientation, Eugene England, who we heard this morning, makes a case for celibacy for gay and lesbian Mormons. Perhaps, despite our uneasiness about the apparent rejection of the body, particularly sexuality, in the great tradition of celibacy in Catholicism and some other religions, we can take some courage and inspiration from the best of that tradition. The vow of lifelong celibacy has been, for many, a form of personal discipline and source of spiritual power that has energized lives of remarkable service. I recommend a similar vow to Mormons of same-sex orientation, that not as a self-punishment or rejection of the body, but as a heroic decision based in devotion to Christ and confident in His response and assistance. By such a vow, you can be freed from the distractions and difficulties of sexual relationship during this life and devote yourself to a focused kind of development and service that many of us who are married will have to achieve in the next life. Here we see that a doctrine of the devils has become a great tradition. If the benefits of lifelong celibacy are so wonderful, why isn't it recommended for heterosexual members of the church as well? Fortunately, the church has stopped recommending marriage as a cure for homosexuality and now says that members with homosexual feelings should not marry. President Gordon B. Hinckley said, "Marriage should not be viewed as a therapeutic step to solve problems such as homosexual inclinations or practices. which first should clearly be overcome with firm and fixed determination never to slip into such practices again. I know many gay men who were promised by their bishops and stake presidents that if they would marry and have children, that their homosexuality would be cured or would go away. I myself never talked to my church leader about the fact that I was gay, but I believed most firmly that if I got married and had children and did what I was supposed to do, that I would be blessed and that it would all be worked out. You know, it's almost as if women in those days were a pill or a prescription that the man was supposed to take in order to get rid of his homosexuality or his homosexual feelings. It didn't work for me, and it hasn't worked for many other gay men that I know. And the result has been great pain and suffering, particularly on the part of wives and family members of these situations. So I'm really pleased that the church has taken the stand that that is no longer to be encouraged. Although I have a couple of cases talked to people where bishops have continued to say that, unfortunately. I'm sure the church justifies the teaching of celibacy by saying that they are against the sin but love the sinner. In fact, the church does not recognize that I, a gay man, exist. Dallin Oaks gave the church's position in his article on same gender attraction. This was in the Ensign. We should know the words homosexual, lesbian, and gay are adjectives to describe particular thoughts, feelings, or behaviors. We should refrain from using these words as nouns to identify particular conditions or specific persons. Our religious doctrine dictates this usage. It is wrong to use these words to denote a condition because it implies that a person is consigned by birth to a circumstance in which he or she has no choice in respect to the critically important matter of sexual behavior. October
1995.
Well, he goes on and talks. He goes on to say that probably some feelings are innate and can't be changed. In fact, in the next paragraph, he goes on to say that. But this was what preceded the recognition that maybe some feelings that we have are not something that we choose.
I remember the article just because I thought it was rather significant. We had a high church leader even suggesting the possibility that it might be connected to something they had rejected.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of friends who expressed that same feeling, but I mean, when I read this, I thought, well, in one sense, you're saying there's feelings, but you're not acknowledging by any, you know, it's still, the whole tone of the article is predicated on the basis that these are feelings and that you can change, and that, and certainly it's based on that if we don't get married in this life, then we will be after the resurrection and we'll want to get married at the time. Yes?
The modern way of saying that it is a sin that you may have the desire to feel something, but you should not feel something. You may have the desire to do it, but you should not do it. It's a more subtle way of trying to point that out, I think, in this article. Admitting that people have the urge to sin, but you should not do it. And I think that's really what he's saying in a very subtle way in this article.
But your point is that there's no such thing as a homosexual.
That's right.
Mm. Everyone
according
is heterosexual.
And I can tell Elder Oaks that I am a gay man and that my homosexual orientation is no more chosen than heterosexual orientation. And I wonder why he thinks it should be any different. I just think it's just kind of cute. Not feminist, not gay, not an intellectual. I'd say he's a golden contact. The church has taught from its earliest times that marriage is essential for exaltation. More recent evolution of policy recognizes marriage as a union of equals, and that sex within marriage is not only for procreation, but also a means of expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds. Why is exaltation, being in a relationship of equals, expressing love and strengthening emotional and spiritual Mormon than it is for a heterosexual Mormon? What a time when the church has come to recognize not only the eternal importance of marriage, but also the spiritual and emotional importance. Gay members are told they cannot enjoy any of these benefits, but must lead celibate, lonely lives. I know from personal experience that this is not emotionally or spiritually healthy. The church's opposition to gay marriage raises a number of questions. Why is the church fighting to keep gay men and lesbians from even enjoying the civil benefits of marriage? What will the church's position be on civil unions approved in Vermont? Can two men or two women who have been joined in civil union be members in good standing in the church? There are certainly many issues that the church will continue to face in coming to terms with gay members. The teaching on marriage and celibacy are likely to continue to evolve. I purposely wore this t-shirt today because I thought it was pretty good. This is Brigham Young, and his wives lined up behind him, and two pioneer men holding hands and two pioneer women holding hands, and he says, but that's not normal. And I think up here a couple of the wives are winking at each other, so why did this policy evolve in a way that excludes gay members? Are there other evolutions that would have been more inclusive? Assume for a minute, what if the church followed this line of reasoning? One, there's credible scientific and sociological data to indicate that sexual orientation is not chosen and is not amenable to change. The scriptures say very little about homosexuality. The Book of Mormon, the most perfect book on earth, and the Doctrine and Covenants say nothing. The few scriptures that are there have little to do with our present-day understanding of homosexuality. Since marriage is essential for exaltation and spiritual and emotional well-being, we encourage all members to get married. All members should play by the same rules. No sex before marriage and fidelity in marriage. In order to play by the rules, gay members of the church can marry. I'm sure that probably seems a far-fetched line of reasoning to a lot of people, but it certainly would be one way that things could develop as change takes place. The church says its gay members, if they want to play, have to play by the same rules as everyone, but then proceed to give us different rules, again referring to Elder Oak's article on same-gender attraction. The First Presidency has declared that there is a distinction between 1, immoral thoughts and feelings, and two, participating in either immoral heterosexual or any homosexual behavior. So there is nothing a gay person can do to make the expression of his or her love for another person acceptable. By definition, any expression of same-sex attraction is sin. This double standard is carried to extremes. It is acceptable for unmarried heterosexuals to hold hands, kiss, hug, and show affection as long as they do not go all the way. It is not acceptable for me to show any kind of affection to the man I love. A friend of mine summed up the situation well. Defenders of the current church policy argue, we have the same standard for all our members, which is complete abstinence before marriage and complete fidelity thereafter. By insisting that the standard is universal, they apply that the playing field is level. Is it? One part of the membership, the majority, receives enthusiastic encouragement to enter into rewarding relationships, while a small part of the membership is prohibited from entering into rewarding relationships. To be one of the favored, one for whom the standards of divinely approved relationship falls conveniently into the path they would have preferred anyway, regardless of whether or not they even cared about divine approval, these favored ones are awarded the status of having righteous desires. The unfavored ones, seeking a rewarding relationship just as much as the favored ones, are met with condemnation and excommunication, and their desires are called unrighteous. The majority group comes to believe they are morally superior because of their involuntary desires. The minority either come to believe that they are morally inferior, or they begin to suspect that the majority group is not necessarily as morally superior as they like to assume. It is not a level playing field. I would like to, since I have a public audience, conclude my presentation by saying some personal things. As I told you, I have asked that my name be removed from the records of the church. This has been a very difficult decision for me to make, and I don't really have a big gripe with most of the members of the church I know, but more with the leadership that's going on. Also, in a public forum, I would like to acknowledge the debt I have to my former wife, who at great sacrifice to herself and great pain set me free to find out who I was and to become the man that I am. And I cherish her friendship and love dearly. I also like to acknowledge my in-laws, her parents, who have worked very hard to keep me in the family. I'm always included in all the family dinners and get-togethers and celebrations. And I cherish that very much also. I do know that God loves me. He loves me as the gay man that I am, and that I'm expected to try to live a moral and honest life and to serve others. And I'm thankful for this knowledge. Thank you very much.
Just a couple minutes for questions or comments, Robert.
Okay. Yes.
Robert, some thing that I, as I listen to you, a thing that I've been hearing over and over again, from what you said, is a sense of a heroism that the church places on people who must be celibate for one reason or another. And I hear that theme running regularly when it comes to people with disability, when it comes to people who have same-sex orientation, and when it comes to single women. And at the same time, I also hear the opposite and accept that opposite as part of kind of a historic thing. When Paul was writing to, whoever wrote Romans was writing, the writers tells us that if certain people cannot stand not to be married, that they ought to marry. And that is the opposite perspective that I think that comes through in early, well, cannot say that early, but in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, you know, don't forgive it, that kind of teaching about same-sex oriented men needing to marry as a way of resolving their same-sex orientation.
Yeah, part of this in my feeling is that while many people due to circumstances in their life would be living in a celibate situation, you know, for a single woman or a single man that are heterosexual, that is potentially a temporary condition. You know, they can always meet someone and then get married and would no longer be celibate. Point that I think is that is it set up, a gay person has no hope of having a relationship. So it is a lifelong situation that they would be asked to. And I see that.
Regardless, it's a pedestal situation where you set an impossible task for certain people in the church, meaning. In particular, women and people with disabilities, where you set them up to fail.
Mm-hmm.
To set them up to say to never be married and never have that joy, and then say, well, at some future date, and that that I may be thinking too earthbound here, but the point is, I think that it is simply a contradiction in the church that some are told, well, do it if you have to, and others are told, you're a hero if you don't.
I guess I'd like to quibble a little bit with the idea of a level playing field, because I don't think doctrinally our church or any other church particularly teaches that life should be a level playing field. I mean, if you think of Christ and the payment of the workers in the vineyard, clearly that's not there by anybody's current reckoning. And so I guess when they say it's not level, i.e. the statements aren't the same, maybe they're not. Where I think the church needs to learn, and I think it's making strides in this, is that the personal human cost level of anyone who's in a situation that doesn't match the ideal, whether they be, heterosexual, single, homosexual, whether they have disabilities, whether they may have mental illness that prevents, normal social interaction, that we as Christians and as Mormons need to learn to respond in a charitable way at that level, because, there's pain and loneliness and cost that occur through a variety of situations. And that we need to share in that and help each other with it. With Christ as the appropriate example. But I'm sort of saying, I don't see what the deal is. Like, it should be a level playing field, because life is not like that.
Well, life certainly is not easy. It's not fair. You're right. There are Christian churches, United Church of Christ for one, that has recognize the validity of same-sex relationships, does perform same-sex unions, ministers are able to be ordained who are gay, and they've accepted that. I think part of the level playing field is that in that last thing I put up, that any homosexual activity is there's no recognition of this.
We need to wrap up.
Yeah.
So can we
have
maybe just a couple of these?
quick comments.
Very quick. Follow up on what you just said about the United Church of Christ. They do that congregation by congregation. The option is open, but the congregation...
Yeah, the congregation, well, that's because the congregation decides everything in it, but the national policy is that they ordain openly gay men, and the congregation may choose to hire them or not hire them, right?
Or protecting those religions.
Yeah, right.
Question I'd like to pose to everyone. Based on experiences, I guess more people that you know, is it your sense that when church leaders advise people of same-sex orientation not to marry, that they did it on the basis of any evidence, anecdote, or is it wishful thinking / inspiration?
You say not to marry?
Yes.
I mean, this is totally my opinion. I mean, I don't have any basis to back up. I mean, I think generally bishops are very ill-prepared to counsel someone who's homosexual, that they're probably very limited. I mean, they're probably saying, God, what do I say, you know? And that, I mean, in the past they said, you know, get married and it'll all be solved. I think that basically is the church's teaching, that if you obey the commandments and do what you're supposed to do, the Lord will bless you and you will be able to overcome whatever the problem is you have. And it's my understanding that, I did look in the Handbook of Instructions. It is there now that bishops and such are told not to counsel homosexual people to get married.
But you know of no instances where local or general authorities would say, well, I know someone and... he married, and now he's just doing fine.
Oh yeah, but it's people who've gone through Evergreen or one of the XK movements first, and then in the recent article that Dean Bird published, he talks very clearly that there. I mean, he says look at scientific evidence, which he says shows that people can change. And he quotes one source to substantiate this, and so there. I mean, still, I think officially the stand of the church is that these are feelings and thoughts, and so they can be changed, and you can live differently.
I'm sorry, we really need to wrap up.
Okay.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you very much. Yeah.